ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Monday, the 25th of March. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people. Today, Russia's deadliest terrorist attack in 20 years claims more than 130 lives. Has Vladimir Putin taken his eye off the ball when it comes to domestic security? And with Easter around the corner, could we soon see a spike in the price of chocolate? The warning comes amid a push to improve global cocoa supplies.
It's really unsustainable at the moment, and they're under a lot of pressure from European consumers to improve farmer living incomes for families, to stop deforestation and stop child labour.
First today, the minimum wage in Australia is $23.23 an hour, and the federal government has today revealed it's looking for that to rise. It doesn't want workers' wages to go backwards as a result of inflation, so has urged the Fair Work Commission to up the minimum rate as part of its annual wages review. The move's been welcomed by those on the minimum wage, but business owners and the opposition aren't so sure, as Oliver Gordon reports.
Each year, the country's wages umpire, the Fair Work Commission, reviews the national minimum wage. Last year, with inflation running hot, it raised the rate by 5.75%. To accommodate for his increased wages bill, Broken Hill cafe owner Dylan Stone had to increase the price of his big brekkie by $3.
It went up to $28. Now, I still think it's very good value for your money. You get, you know, I would say one of the biggest big brekkies in town. But the thing is, that $28, that's a lot of money. That, for a lot of people, that's an hour's work.
He sees the merit of workers getting a pay rise, but says many small businesses are struggling to stay afloat. He hopes the Fair Work Commission's next decision on the minimum pay rate, to take effect from the 1st of July, strikes the right balance.
In the end, people just won't be able to afford to go out and eat, and businesses just won't be able to afford to stay open. And I think we're seeing that now, but I think the worst might be yet to come if they don't get this right.
Nairi Bogerman is the president of the National Union of Students and sees it slightly differently. She says many of the minimum wage workers she represents are opting out of study because they can't afford to live.
University dropout rates are actually at the highest rate they have been since 2005. This is owing largely to cost of living pressures.
She hopes the federal government gets its way and the minimum wage is increased.
We're finding now that students are actually having to work as a priority and fit their education in around that.
The federal government will push for minimum and award wage increases that keep pace with inflation, which has been sitting at 4.1% over the year to December 2023. Tony Burke is the Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations.
The real wages of low-paid workers shouldn't be going backwards. That's very much where we draw a line that we don't want crossed.
The minimum wage was increased significantly last year, but inflation has eased since then, meaning the Fair Work Commission may be less inclined to consider as much of an increase this time round. There have also been a number of cost-of-living measures handed down, including tax cuts for lower-paid workers. Federal Treasurer Jim Chalmers is urging the employment umpire to consider the need for an increase to the minimum wage as separate to these initiatives.
Well, we don't see cost of living relief as instead of decent wages growth. We want to see decent wages growth on top of the billions of dollars in cost of living relief that the Albanese government is rolling out.
Wage rise or not, Shadow Finance Minister Jane Hume says the government isn't doing enough to tackle cost of living.
If they're using the tax cuts as their only solution to the cost of living crisis, that's a recipe for disaster. There should be a far broader plan to tackle the cost of living, and we've been saying this now since Labor came to government.
Meanwhile, according to the Reserve Bank Governor, the economic outlook remains uncertain. In comments released last week, Governor Bullock indicated wages growth picked up a little in the December quarter, but appears to have peaked, with indications the figure will moderate over the year ahead.
Oliver Gordon. Australia's spy agencies have been coaxed out into the open to appear at an unusual public hearing into Australia's secrecy laws. The laws have fueled debate in recent years about whether journalists and whistleblowers in Australia need better legal protections. In a notable intervention, the head of ASIO told this morning's hearings that some of the laws may not be fit for purpose, but argued others should stay unchanged to stop foreign spies or adversaries posing as journalists to steal Australian secrets. Jacqueline Breen reports.
Jake Blight is only a couple of months into the job as the independent monitor of Australia's national security laws and says there's a lot to keep across.
If you were to add up sort of the number of pages that deal with our security and our law enforcement intelligence and all their powers, you'd be looking at about 3,000 plus pages. That's about the same number as the complete works of William Shakespeare, Tolstoy's War and Peace, and all three volumes of Lord of the Rings added together.
He's the first full-time watchdog since the position was created back in 2010 and has launched his own inquiry into whether the secrecy provisions in Australia's national security laws are fit for purpose.
Well, common countries that we compare ourselves to, like Britain, Canada, New Zealand, all have offences, but it is fair to say that Australia's are perhaps more far-reaching and the penalties are higher. And comparing those laws is one of the things I'll be looking at over the next couple of days.
Press freedom and human rights advocates have welcomed the inquiry and are hoping for change. Journalist and academic Peter Grester is chair of the media freedom advocacy group, the Alliance for Journalists' Freedom.
Australia is, as the New York Times mentioned in a story a few years back, Australia might well be the world's most secretive democracy. We're not the worst in the world for media freedom. We're not seeing journalists being locked up or have their fingernails ripped out in the way that they are in some other countries. But the legislation does the job that it's supposed to, and that's deter a lot of whistleblowers from coming forward. It stops a lot of journalists from carrying out essential investigations. And it creates a culture of secrecy within government that I think undermines the substance of our democracy.
One focus of the inquiry is a law that makes it a criminal offence for any non-Commonwealth officer, such as journalists, to simply receive classified information, regardless of what they go on to do with it. Critics say the law criminalises investigative journalism. That was put to ASIO Director General Mike Burgess this morning.
Obviously, I'll defer to Attorney General's Department and others on how the law should be structured around this, but in terms of your specific question of mere receipt, secrecy provisions are here for deterrence purposes. Once someone's received something, then the deterrence has not had its effect. So mere receipt perhaps should not be, and that's not the issue as far as I'm concerned. It's what happens next. As you remarked in your opening statement, of course, if then someone decides to hold on to something and keep it for reasons which are not defendable and then all start communicating to others, that's the problem that we need to focus on.
Beyond that, Mr. Burgess and his counterparts in the other security agencies are against any watering down of the current laws. This morning, he argued against the creation of any exemption for journalists by warning it could be exploited.
Journalists are a target of foreign intelligence services, and foreign intelligence services use journalists' cover and tradecraft, as in pretend to be a journalist, to do their job. And therefore, I'd always be interested in any special treatment of journalists, and I mean that in a positive sense, in terms of the ability of a foreign service to use that to their advantage, to our nation's detriment.
The public hearing will continue today and tomorrow, and the independent monitor Jake Blight says he'll also take evidence in private if necessary before making a report to the government in May.
Jacqueline Breen. On ABC Radio across Australia and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. Four men have appeared in a Moscow court on terrorism charges following the weekend's attack on Crocus City Hall, where more than 130 people were killed. Sunday was declared a national day of mourning in Russia. Thousands of people flocked to the scene of the attack to lay flowers and light candles. It was Russia's deadliest attack in 20 years and looks to be the work of an arm of Islamic State known as ISIS-K. Dr. Mariam Farida is a lecturer in terrorism and counter-terrorism studies at Macquarie University. Mariam Farida, what's the motivation for the attack?
this is probably fitting in the context of how the group is trying to re-emerge in Afghanistan, Iran, Pakistan, and Turkmenistan, so that region. And there is a historical context of the rivalry between those groups and those areas and Russia. We need to look at the Soviet invasion in Afghanistan, Russia's actions in Chechnya, and then most importantly, Moscow's relationship with the Syrian Assad regime and the Iranian governments. And that was during the military campaigns that Russia was involved in and has waged against ISIS fighters in Syria.
The US issued specific warnings about the threats that were current. Why do you think nothing was done within Moscow? And with all that's going on in Ukraine, is Russia's security eye off the ball here?
Well, this is something the terrorist groups excel in and try to take advantage of, is when they see there's a distraction in terms of the country's domestic policy or foreign policy. This is exactly their chance to try to re-emerge, to create some propaganda war online, and then to try to start recruitment. And we know now there's a huge distraction in the world materializing in the Ukraine-Russia war, the Israel war on Gaza, and all of the other things that are distracting the world. And this is why we've been academics and experts in this field, we've been trying to warn and say there will be more likely more terrorist attacks that will be taking place in this climate that we are living now. It probably will not take place in Russia, but it will take place in other places as well. So I think now the government agencies and law enforcement agencies need to pay closer attention to how far these groups are able to then stretch with their global reach.
Are there implications for the West here?
Of course, because not only Russia is seen as a specific target, the US is also seen as a specific target, and other Western countries who have been involved in any of the military attacks or any of the military involvement in Syria and Iraq. And more recently, we don't know if the propaganda that ISIS-K will use the context of the Israel war in Gaza to gather even more global influence and try to highlight the implications of the Western government's participation in what's happening in Gaza.
Vladimir Putin didn't mention ISIS-K in his remarks. He instead wanted to deflect criticism and put accusations on Ukraine. Is this because he's embarrassed about this attack?
It could be. Look, it is a big shock for the Russian intelligence agencies to show that a terrorist attack of this magnitude is successful within Russia and within the capital, Moscow. It could be that they are still waiting to get a little bit more information about those involved in the attack. It could be that this is a way that the Russian president is trying to use this strategically in his war against Ukraine. And it could be that he doesn't want to admit that a group such as ISIS-K, that now they were able to actually commit such a horrible attack within Moscow. So it could have so many different layers, but it definitely reflects a certain loops in the security in Russia, within Russia.
Dr. Mariam Farida, thanks for joining the world today.
Thank you.
That's Mariam Farida, who's a lecturer in terrorism studies in the Department of Security Studies and Criminology at Macquarie University. It was news that shut down the gossips and the conspiracy theorists in one fell swoop. Catherine, Princess of Wales, revealed at the weekend that she's fighting cancer. At 42 years old, she's part of a growing cohort of younger people to be diagnosed. Worldwide, more and more people under 50 are developing cancers, and Catherine's battle might shed an important light on early detection in younger people. Alison Schau reports.
After months of speculation, gossip and conspiracies about her absence from public life, Catherine, Princess of Wales, revealed the reason.
The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present. For everyone facing this disease, please do not lose faith or hope. You are not alone.
The story has resonated with many cancer patients around the world, including Adelaide mother of three, Nina DeSanto.
I was 42 when I was diagnosed with bowel cancer, around that same age as Kate, and it comes as a huge shock. You're definitely blindsided by cancer in that age group. You're right in the thick of your parenting and your career, and to be slugged with that was a huge shock.
In Australia, more and more people are getting that shock from an earlier age, with more than 10% of bowel cancer diagnoses now occurring in people under 50. Dr. Norman Swan is the co-host of the Health Report on ABC Radio. He says monitoring and advocating for your own health is an important message for younger people.
If you're young and you've got a symptom you've never had before, bleeding from your back passage, bruising, weight loss, tummy pain, go and get it checked up. Just because you're young doesn't mean to say you couldn't have cancer.
He says it's difficult to pinpoint exactly what's behind the rise in cancer rates among people under 50.
In rich countries like Australia, people don't know why cancer rates are going up in young people. Colon cancer, breast cancer, testicular cancer, kidney cancer, lung cancer in young women.
Oncologist Dr. Ranjana Srivastava says recent research points to diet and exercise as a contributing factor to the increase.
The rise in cancer incidence is most likely explained by, you know, what we loosely call lifestyle factors, whether that's alcohol, smoking, obesity, something to do with nutrition, highly processed foods, especially in the rich world, sugary drinks, reduced exercise.
Nina DeSanto says one of the obstacles to early diagnosis is that cancer is still being thought of as an older person's disease.
There is still a medical bias, which I think could be remedied with support and education.
Mr. Santo says looking back, there were symptoms she missed, and she believes early screening would have changed the course of her health journey. She's now an advocate for Bowel Cancer Australia, which successfully campaigned for the National Health and Medical Research Council to drop the recommended screening age for bowel cancer from 50 to 45. However, the federal government is yet to fund screenings for the 45 to 49-year-old age group.
Lowering the screening age would make a huge difference, particularly to younger onset patients. And so that was really exciting to hear as a patient that they're working on that, and we just need some funding.
Now living with stage 4 bowel cancer, Nina DeSanto says she's facing treatment for life.
Any young onset cancer has got unique challenges. And there are things like fertility, career progression, parenting. You may even be looking at caring for your parents. It is hard. It's hard being a parent in the thick of things and wanting to be returning to work, but not being able to due to the impact of all the treatments and surgeries that I have.
The Cancer Council says it's important for any younger patients who notice signs of concern to go to the doctor, because early detection is one of the keys to saving lives.
Alison Shao. Now to some concerning new figures on the Australian economy. Manufacturers are reporting the weakest levels of orders from retailers since the global financial crisis. But the Australian share market is today flirting with a fresh record high. Business reporter David Taylor joined me earlier to help make sense of this. David, it sounds like Australia's manufacturing sector is quite weak. What's going on?
Well, Rachel, Westpac and the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry talk to Australian manufacturers to find out basically how they're going. They've produced the ACCI Westpac Survey of Industrial Trends. Now, the ACCI Westpac actual composite is one measure of manufacturing activity within that survey. Now, it weakened in the opening quarter of 2024, the first 3 months, and it shifted down. Why? Well, new orders are down. So in the March quarter, 13% of respondents reported a decline in new orders. Why is that? Well, the survey suggests that softer demand in the economy, so retailers asking for less stuff from manufacturers, and a slower than usual return to business from the summer holidays, which also explains the unemployment result we got last week. So this is the largest share, Rachel, of respondents reporting declining new orders since the global financial crisis. And that's significant.
So what does a fall in orders from retailers mean for the wider economy and unemployment?
Well, over half of manufacturers expect things to get worse. What do I mean by things? Well, it's the economy and the outlook for employment. So the March quarter survey reported a decline in new orders, a fall in output and a reduction in overtime and a material downsize to employment. So, Rachel, is this the start of a wave of job losses? Because that is the bottom line. And will those job losses losses begin in the Australian manufacturing sector. Here's the Chief Executive of the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, Andrew McKellar.
There is certainly clear signs that the economy is weaker than it's been at any time in the past couple of years. Orders are down. The labour market is softening. We need to get that balance right, and we need to ensure that we don't push the economy too far.
Andrew McKellar, you just said then the labour market is softening and the Reserve Bank is looking very, very carefully at the jobs market for any sign of weakness. Does this point, this weakness in the manufacturing sector, does it point to a potential surge in unemployment as the weeks and months progress?
Well, we have to get that balance right. I mean, there's no doubt that hiring decisions are starting to slow down. It's going beyond simply reducing the number of hours worked.
Are you worried about an unemployment surge?
Oh, look, I think we've had a very strong labour market up until now. We want to keep it that way for as long as possible. So we're certainly hopeful that we won't see unemployment going sharply higher.
That's ACCI Chief Executive Andrew McKellar. And David, at the same time as what you're telling me, the share market is again approaching record highs. How can this be in light of what you've just explained?
Look, Rachel, it is a bit of a head-scratcher, but the share market is looking at banks, miners and gas companies, and we've just been talking about Australia's industrial base. And there is a bit of a disconnect, but as we go to where the S&P ASX 200 is not far off its all-time high. Now, energy stocks, as I mentioned, are doing well. The iron ore price seems to have stabilised, and a lot of our mining companies depend on a stronger iron ore price. And of course, Rachel, renewed optimism that interest rates, which is what it's all about, may become coming down soon.
David Taylor. Easter's right around the corner, and along with hot cross buns, chocolate Easter eggs and Easter bunnies will be on many shopping lists this week. But with the skyrocketing costs of cocoa around the world, how much longer will Australians be able to afford the decadent luxury? Rima Chia reports.
Tina Angelidis is gearing up for the Easter long weekend. The co-founder of Sydney company Adora Chocolates says it's a time of peak demand.
So these next 4 days of our Easter week is actually our busiest period of the whole year. Christmas is over a longer period, but the actual 4 days of Easter is by far our busiest.
Adora sources their key cocoa ingredient from Belgium, and Tina says her business has been squeezed by rising import costs. Along with inflation, she's seen a 10% drop in sales since last October.
We're about to do a big price change straight after Easter. We've been hesitating. We sort of knew this price change was coming. I've been in the industry for 30 years, and I don't think I've ever had such a huge increase in chocolate.
Peter Millard is the Chief Operating Officer of Haig's Chocolates, which has been making chocolate in Australia for more than 100 years. Haig sources their cocoa from Papua New Guinea, Africa and South America, and Mr. Millard says he expects costs to rise.
Yeah, look, for us, we're a premium brand and we've always purchased premium cocoa. So while this will have an impact on us, we think that we're a brand that is already built in for premium cocos. It's part of the combination of costs that go into our product range.
Cocoa, the main ingredient in making chocolate, has been under severe global pressures in recent years. Climate change and plant diseases are largely to blame, with unethical and unsustainable farming practices adding to the strain. David Guest, a professor of plant pathology at the University of Sydney, says cocoa supplies are particularly vulnerable to instability.
Cocoa was planted as a colonial plantation crop. It's really thrived on poverty of those smallholder farmers. So two-thirds or 70% of the world's cocoa comes from West Africa, and those farmers live on less than $2 a day. They don't really have the resources or the labour to implement effective management practices.
The price of cocoa is volatile. It swung from $2,500 a tonne to almost $9,000 in just a few months. David Guest says there's little incentive for farmers to be more sustainable as the profits don't hit their pockets.
We're really heading to a cliff, and they're under a lot of pressure from European consumers to improve farmer living incomes for families, to stop deforestation and stop child labour.
For Chris Jenke, CEO of Charlie's Chocolate, growing cocoa locally in far north Queensland keeps costs low and is more sustainable.
Look, it has certainly benefited us in the sense that it gives us a kind of a buffer. Having said all of that, we do actually supplement our own production of cocoa here with some imported cocoa beans from Papua New Guinea.
While prices have risen for Chris, he hopes the supply chain stabilises and producers overseas can reap the benefits.
The farmers in places like West Africa and also South America were struggling to make a living. So I think it's become sustainable for the chocolate industry and provides hopefully a better return ultimately for some of those growers in places like West Africa.
That's the chief executive of Charlie's Chocolate, Chris Janke, ending that report from Rima Chia. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Right now, thousands of people across the country are receiving unwelcome attention from the ATO as the tax office works to recover historical debts that it had previously put on hold. Today, business reporter Nassim Kadem on why the ATO is trying to recover the funds now and why some people are comparing it to robo-debt. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.